We are starting our first regular lesson on lessons from the Holy Lands tonight. If you were with us on Wednesday, we did a little introduction where we talked about the geography of the country. We talked a little bit about the archaeology. If you weren't here and didn't get a chance to be a part of that, it is on Facebook if you want to rewatch it. Tonight, my goal is to cover three sites in Israel. If I run out of time, we'll drop them and leave them for the next time. Okay. But I struggled a little bit with how to organize this. I thought, well, do I organize these like into Old Testament sites and New Testament sites? But then that'll cause me to have to jump around the country into different areas. And so what I decided is the way I like to cover it is I'm going to kind of start on the coast. Wow, what happened to that? Okay. I'm going to start on the coast. Something happened to the graphic here in translation, so you can't really read anything that's on there. But I'm going to start on the coast, and then I'm going to make kind of a clockwise route around the country, kind of going up into Galilee, and then coming down the Jordan River Valley to the Dead Sea area, and then down to, this is Beersheba, trust me, and then moving up to the Judean Mountains into Jerusalem. And starting off, the first place I want to talk about is a place called Caesarea Maritima. Now, you're not going to find the name Maritima in Scripture. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But Caesarea, as it is known in the New Testament, was on the coast, or still is, on the coast of the Mediterranean. So this is on the coastal plain of Israel. Magnificent ruins at Caesarea. But this, again, this place in Scripture is only referred to as Caesarea. Now, Maritima, the reason why they call it that today is Maritima just means by the sea, literally means by the sea, and it is by the sea. When you read about it in Scripture, again, it just says Caesarea. It's not to be confused with another Caesarea in Scripture, which is Caesarea Philippi. How can you tell the difference? Well, every time Caesarea Philippi is referenced, it says Caesarea Philippi, and every time Caesarea Maritima is meant, it's just Caesarea. Why are there multiple places named Caesarea? Because they were named after various Caesars who were the emperors of the Roman Empire. So even though Caesarea Philippi and Caesarea Maritima are in very different parts of the country, we'll talk about Caesarea Philippi later, but this is Caesarea on the sea. Like a lot of things in Israel, from the time just before and just after, from just before the time of Jesus, this city, like many things around the time of Jesus, was built by Herod the Great. Herod the Great, who was a regional leader in the Roman Empire, he is known as Herod the Great not because he was a great man. He was a horrible man. He is the Herod who was in power when Jesus was born. He is the one who had all the male babies killed. He had one of his wives killed, who he had married. Really, he had married a Jewish woman just to get in the good graces of the Jews, and ultimately had her killed. And there was a quote about him that it'd be better to be his dog than to be in his family. This was not a good man. But he is known as Herod the Great because he was a great builder. He was a magnificent builder, and his fingerprints are all over Israel today. And he built the city of Caesarea, and he named it after his friend, Caesar Augustus. And that's why it's called Caesarea. Now, they estimate the time in which he built this was 22 to 10 BC approximately. So we're talking about just before the time of Jesus. Within the 20 or so years before Jesus, leading up to just before his birth. Why was Caesarea built? Well, when the Romans took over Palestine, one of the things that they did not have was a harbor, was a port. The Roman Empire was a massive, powerful empire, and this is a significant place for them to have a stronghold, and they had no harbor. Prior to Caesarea, the primary place that ships would come in and out was Joppa in Scripture, today known as Jaffa, which was a tiny little place compared to Caesarea. So Herod built this out of necessity for the Roman Empire. At its peak, Caesarea was a city of up to 100,000 people. So this was a significant city. The project to turn this place into a harbor was a massive project. There is no natural harbor in natural bay or anything like that in Caesarea. It's just a straight coast. And so there was lots and lots of materials brought in, including sandstone and lead that were used to build out the harbor out into the Mediterranean. All the remains of the harbor itself today are actually underwater. We'll talk about that in just a minute. They're not visible above the water today. But Caesarea continued to be a significant city through many historical ages, throughout the Roman Empire, and then after the Roman Empire fell, it was taken over by the Byzantines, eventually taken over by Muslims. Then there were structures built within the city by the Crusaders, so you can look at all these kind of historical eras. And because of that, the excavations today are from all those different time periods. We'll focus mostly on the time period of Herod and time period of Scripture, but I will show you a few things from outside of that as we go through this. Now, one, besides this being the major harbor city of the Roman Empire, another reason why it is historically significant, the ruins at Caesarea are historically significant, is that it gives us insight into the way Romans built their cities. This wasn't a city that the Romans took over. They built this city. Herod the Great built it. And so you can, when you are in Israel, it doesn't take long if you go into an ancient city to go, this was an Israelite city, a Jewish city, or this was a Roman city, because the Roman cities were all built on a grid. You know, we think about grid being like a modern thing, like New York, everything's on a grid. You know, I can tell you that my favorite pizza place in New York is at the corner of 49th and 6th Avenue. Everything's on a grid, so you can find stuff easily. Well, that started a long time ago, and Caesarea was built on a grid. They called it the Hippomedian Plan, named after Hippodamius of Miletus. And again, it was built on a grid. And this is an artist's rendition of what it would have looked like in its heyday. And again, you can see all of the structures built on a grid plan, just like a modern city like New York. The difference, if you go into an ancient city that was built by the Israelites or by the Jews, it's like Nashville. Everything is just curving, and I mean, there's nothing that hits the right spot. It's just, you know, every street is just it's a mess. And that's how you can kind of tell the difference in Roman, what the Romans built and what the Jews built. So a lot of structure to what they did. Now, let's talk about Scripture. Caesarea Maritima is only mentioned in the book of Acts, but it is mentioned extensively in the book of Acts. This is a very, very important city in the book of Acts. Many of the references in Acts have to do with people coming and going from country of Israel. Okay, I've got some examples on here, like when Saul, who became Paul, after he was converted and he went to Jerusalem, he feared for his life, and Barnabas helped him escape, and he ended up going to Tarsus. Well, Tarsus is in modern day Turkey, and it says that he went through Caesarea to get there. Okay, so he went through the port at Caesarea. Why go through Caesarea? Because that's where you got on the boats at. That's where you got a ride. And so that's where he went. The first mention of Caesarea in Scripture, though, is a little bit earlier, actually one chapter earlier, with Philip the evangelist, one of those men who was selected to be a servant, a deacon in the early church. After his conversion with the eunuch, what happened to him? He disappeared, right? And he found himself by the Spirit in Caesarea. The next time that we find Philip in Scripture is at the end of Paul's third missionary journey, when he comes back to Israel. He comes back in through Caesarea, and he stays with Philip and his family, and he had the daughters who prophesied. All of that was in Caesarea. Another big thing about Caesarea is Caesarea was the home of Cornelius. Who was Cornelius? The first Gentile convert. When the angel appeared to Cornelius and told him to call for Peter, Cornelius was in Caesarea. Peter was in Joppa, just south on the Mediterranean from Caesarea. But Cornelius was in Caesarea, and when Peter came to Cornelius, he came to Caesarea. So all of that, the conversion of Cornelius and his family, all of that took place in the city of Caesarea. Some other things. In Acts chapter 12, you have the Apostle James, who becomes the first apostle to lose his life. He is killed by Herod Agrippa I. We're past the time of Herod the Great. We're now into his son, Herod Agrippa I. Herod Agrippa I executed the Apostle James. He saw that it pleased the people, so what did he do? He arrested Peter. Presumably, he was going to have Peter executed as well. The Lord rescued Peter. Herod had the guards killed, and then Herod went to Caesarea. Why would he go to Caesarea? Well, his father had built a massive palace in Caesarea, and so possibly going there, but he went there to meet with some people, and while he was there, the people were declaring him to be a god. He did not disagree with them, and what happened? God struck him down, had him eaten with worms. All of that happened in Caesarea. Okay, we see again through the missionary journeys that Paul, you know, would leave from Antioch, and on a couple of the journeys he came back through Caesarea again. Why? Because it was a port city. The last time that Caesarea is mentioned in Scripture, and it's an extensive mention, but it's in beginning in chapter 23 of Acts. You have where Paul has come back to Jerusalem at the end of his third missionary journey, and the Jews are upset by him. We talked about that in our Acts class. And ultimately, there's a riot. The Romans take him prisoner. He's rescued from the Jews. And the Romans, to save him from the Jews, send him to Caesarea. And when they send him to Caesarea, he goes... Felix is the governor, and Felix says to put him in Herod's praetorium. It says that in Acts 23. Put him in Herod's praetorium, and that's where he was held. And so the Herod's praetorium would have been his palace, Herod the Great's palace that was there in Caesarea, and the ruins of that palace are there today. So that's a biblical overview of what happened in Caesarea. One other significant historical thing. Most of us are familiar with the historical event that the city of Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans in AD 70. Okay? But the precursor to that was the Great Jewish Revolt, which began AD 66, AD 67, depending on which historical source you read from. Well, I'd sign it different dates, but that revolt, the first Jewish revolt, which ultimately led to the Romans destroying, you know, everything, including Jerusalem, that began in the synagogue in Caesarea. So again, that's outside of Scripture, but the Jewish revolt, which resulted in the destruction of Jerusalem, began in Caesarea. Now, I didn't just put this picture up there just as a gratuitous way to get a picture of my family up there, mostly. But this was just to show you that Caesarea, when it says by the sea, it's by the sea. It is right on the Mediterranean. Most beautiful water. If you've ever been to the Caribbean, water looks very similar to the water in the, you know, like in St. Martin or Aruba or some of those places where it's just turquoise and you can see all the way to the bottom. That's what it looks like in Caesarea. Just absolutely stunningly beautiful water. And Herod, we are standing, and I'll get to this in a minute, we are standing in the lower part of the palace of Herod the Great. So where did he build his palace? He built it with the best view on the sea. You're right there on the Mediterranean. And this is looking at it from Herod's palace up the coast. And again, you can see that, the ruins there right on the Mediterranean. Now, in ancient times, there would have been buildings all up through here, but they've been consumed by the sea. So even though this is a more modern excavation because it's only 2,000 years old. Still, what has been destroyed, a lot of it was destroyed by the sea. Sea and then also earthquake. They've had lots of earthquakes through history. So that's the two big reasons why, if buildings were destroyed in Caesarea, why they were destroyed. Now, I want to talk about a few things. Typical of a Roman city, Caesarea was filled with statues made of marble. And almost all of those statues that have been found are headless. They're beheaded. And the reason why they are headless is because when the Muslims conquered Israel, Islam prohibits icons. So all the statues were beheaded. And so there are, they have found, these incredibly intact 2,000-year-old marble statues all over the place. And almost all of them have no head, because, again, they would have been beheaded by Muslims. Just to show you, though, how there are remains there from many historical eras, this is not a statue that is typical of a Roman city. This is actually a little shepherd boy with a sheep over his shoulder. Now, the face has been disfigured, again, as you would expect, but you would not expect this imagery in Roman statues, and that's because this is not Roman. This is Byzantine. So this is, say, 4th through 6th century AD. So this is, 400 to 600 years after the time of Jesus. But just to give you an idea that there are, it continued to be occupied for many hundreds of years after the time of Jesus. Now, this is the outside of a large theater that was built by Herod the Great. What you are looking at is the outside. All of this is original, except for the metal fence up on top. But all of this is original, and it was built out of sandstone. But once you move inside, these are the seats. This is not original. There has been a lot of restoration that has been done here because finding a relatively intact ancient theater is a hot commodity in these kinds of places because they can use them for events. So while the base of this theater was incredibly well intact, they came in and put just straight up concrete seats in there on top of the ruins so that they could hold concerts in here, which frustrates me. I get it, you want to make money, but it frustrates me because I would like to see what it looked like before they put the seats back in there. But this is a theater, not an amphitheater. In our time, we tend to think of an amphitheater as a half circle. In ancient times, an amphitheater was a full circle or a full oval, okay? And a theater was a half circle, okay? A theater, which is what this is, was always pointed toward the best point of view. Now, I don't have a great picture of this, one, because it's hard to take one, but this theater looked out over the Mediterranean. It always had the best view, and theaters were used for entertainment, okay? So, plays, shows, music, much like what we would have today, these were used for entertainment. Amphitheaters, which were full ovals, full circles, used for games of sport. In many cases, these were games that led to death. These are gladiator fights, these are feeding people with lions, those kinds of things. So anyway, this is a theater and not an amphitheater. I just put this picture in there so you can see the concrete seats. And these seats are sitting right on top of the sandstone, the original sandstone. So it's frustrating to me that some of these places are being rebuilt for commercial reasons. But anyway, they when I was there 2 years ago, they were working on this stage, and they're still working on it. And that's why I can't show you the view, because you can't see it because of the stage. It's so huge. But they built this modern stage at the front of this 2,000-year-old amphitheater so that they can hold concerts here. So kind of frustrating. But I did get to talk to the group here, and I one of the things I emphasized was how just seeing this place can, those passages in Scripture where you might just read that, well, Paul went to Tarsus through Caesarea and he just kind of breezed through it, and you go, wait a minute, this was a real place. This was This was a real harbor. This is a historical place that was built by Herod the Great. So kind of a cool thing to be able to experience that. Throughout the remains, though, in the city, I've got a few slides here just to talk about building materials. This is to show you the power and might of the Roman Empire. I've already shown you a couple statues out of marble. One of those didn't come from the Roman period. But lots of columns, lots of sarcophaguses, lots of things made of materials that are not native to Israel. Okay, there is no marble in Israel. Okay, but yet you find the remains of marble columns and statues all over Caesarea. Here's a marble sarcophagus that has been uncovered from Caesarea. These are columns that are made out of two different types of granite. There's no granite in Israel. So all of these materials were brought in. You know, and that's hard in our day and time, but you think 2,000 years ago, the power and the expanse of the Roman Empire, that they had control of areas where they could go and get marble and get granite. So an incredibly powerful empire and on full display in the city of Caesarea. Moving further up the coast, this is the remains of the lower part of Herod's palace. So again, when you read in Acts 23 that Paul was held by Felix in Herod's praetorium, this is what it's talking about, the palace. Okay. Now again, much of this has been consumed by the sea. What you have are around the outside, you have some the bases of the columns that they have put modern columns up on top just to mark where they were. They actually didn't destroy the columns underneath. We'll see that in just a minute. But this would have been the footprint of the lower part of the palace of Herod. Again, scripture known as Herod's Praetorium. Just at the edge of the palace into the ocean, I think I've shown this slide in a lesson before, but this was Herod's swimming pool. Right out there in the Mediterranean, filled by water from the Mediterranean. And even with, you know, all of the water that comes up on this site, you can see here at the bottom of the picture, mosaics that are still intact, 2,000 years old, you know, made out of little pieces of pottery that where they've made these intricate designs that would have surrounded this, you know, this bathhouse that are still there from 2,000 years ago. So again, all part of Herod's palace. In and around Herod's palace, they found an inscription. Now this is a replica. The original of this is in the Israel Museum, but they have a replica on site at Caesarea. But this inscription says, Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea, dedicated to the Emperor Tiberius. And most likely, the reason why there is an inscription from Pontius Pilate, who was Pontius Pilate? He was a governor. Most likely before he was stationed in Jerusalem, which he was at the time of Jesus, he was stationed at Caesarea. And apparently he built some type of building in honor of Tiberius Caesar. But this inscription found here, which again, that should not be unusual, but not unusual because when we read about Felix and Festus, where are they? They're in Caesarea. What were they? They were governors, just like Pilate was. And so again, it just fits that Pilate was based at some time. He was based in Caesarea. And also tells us this was not a figure made up for a story in Scripture. Pilate was real. And so pretty cool to be able to see that. Again, I mentioned this is what those kind of bases of the columns look like around the outside of Herod's Praetorium, Herod's Temple. So pretty neat to at least be that intact over 2,000 years. This is a view of the Upper Temple. Looking toward what I'm going to, which is the Hippodrome. Now, the Hippodrome, unlike the theater, this is an amphitheater. Okay, this was a full oval. And Hippodrome literally means a horse ring, a horse, like the way of the horse or something like that. I mean, because this is where they would have chariot races. And when this was built, this was in the late kind of Roman period, when this was built, this would have been a full oval. But the side that is toward the Mediterranean has been wiped out by the sea. So that side is no longer there, but the other side is still very, very much intact. You know, this has not been restored. This is original. Now, how long it will stay there, I don't know, because they'll let you just go sit on it. There's a lot of stuff in Israel that you would think, wow, you think that they have security and laser things and whatever. Nope, just wide open. So pretty crazy. All right, this is right outside the Hippodrome. Anybody want to take a guess as to what this is? This is the bathroom, public bathroom. If you need me to explain how it works, I can talk to you after. But just say there would be a water channel running down through here, and the person would sit up here, and you can work out the rest of it on your own. So, but just like if you're having a sporting event today, you have stadiums, what do you have to have? You have to have bathrooms, right? In a hippodrome, where you come for chariot races, you got to have bathrooms. So, again, these are real people, real people. I put this in there. Mike may contradict me, tell me I got this all wrong. That's okay. But one of the things that you will see in any Roman city, ancient Roman city, is lots of arches. And the Romans, it's just referred to as a Roman arch. And the Romans invented this technique for building arches where you have at the top a keystone where the top of the stone is larger than the bottom of the stone so that you can then kind of naturally make an arch. You see this, I should have put a slide up here for the theater where you've got the entryway into the theater. It's a big Roman arch. By the way, the entry exit ways in Roman theaters, literally known as vomitoriums. Yes, that's where we get our word vomit from. Because it said it vomited the people into the theater or out of the theater. Okay, so Romans had a lot of interesting things. But this is, right again, still in the Mediterranean, this is a Roman bathhouse. And you can see, I mean, marble columns still there, marble mosaic tile floor, again, 2,000 years old. Very, very elaborate. Just behind this is an ancient Roman house. The whole floor of this house would have been large mosaics, and again, made up of these tiny little tiles making these intricate pictures. So again, a very, very impressive city. A few more things. This is from outside of Bible times. This is a district that they believe was built by the Byzantines. So when I say Byzantines, that's like 4th to 6th century AD. So 400 to 600 years after the time of Jesus. One of the reasons I show this is that there's all kinds of mosaics in here. Many of them have large kind of cracks through the mosaics, and they believe those were created by earthquakes. There's lots of things that were destroyed by earthquakes over the centuries. This is a fortress, the remains of a fortress from the Crusader period. Crusader period, think 10th to 12th century AD. So these are, you know, sent by the Pope and others who were sent to Crusaders who were sent to Israel to reclaim the Promised Land from the Muslims. There are remains in Caesarea of a Crusader fortress which has a moat around it. You know, that would have been this is a dry moat. It never would have been filled with water. Now, this is not just a picture of the Mediterranean. Okay. This is where the harbor would have been. All of the remains are under the water. I take somebody else's word for that because I have not scuba dived off the coast of the Mediterranean either. But this is where the harbor would have been. And you can see, you know, some of the rock, the base here, the rock that's still, that was built up. But the, again, all of the, you know, sandstone and structures are still are under the water, what's left. But still, when I sit here and look out on this, I picture Paul being rushed away from Jerusalem to save his life and getting a boat to go to Tarsus. Or after Paul has appealed to Caesar and he's on his way to Rome and they get a boat in Caesarea. And I'm thinking about Paul coming through here. So it just really kind of brings it to life. Like, hey, this was a real place. This was really there. Last thing in Caesarea, we may get one more place in, like we're not going to get all three, but we'll This is another Crusader era ruin. This is a gate to the city that was built by the Crusaders. And it's unique, well, somewhat unique, in terms of what we think of as a gate. You actually see this in the old city of Jerusalem as well. But if you go inside this gate, it's shaped like an L. So rather than just having a straight passageway into the city, there's actually, you have to actually go in and turn to get through the gate. It's L-shaped. And the reason why they did that was that if the covering of the gate failed with an invading army, they still had to turn a corner, which would slow the horses down. So the horses could not just get a full head of steam and go straight through the gate. They actually had to make a right-hand turn to go through the gate. So kind of cool. And even in the old city of Jerusalem today, which we'll talk about this later, old city is a misnomer. It is old. It's older than America, but it's not Bible times old. It was the walls around the city were built by the Turks in the 15th century, but several of the gates, and that would have been a few hundred years after this, several of the gates in the old city of Jerusalem are built this exact same way. And you see the little slits there; those are for the archers. They'll stand in the windows and shoot their arrows at invading armies. So again, not biblical, but kind of being from a historical perspective. I said the last thing about Caesarea. There is one more thing. This is further up the coast, but further up the coast are the remains of an aqueduct. Aqueduct just literally means water carrier, but an aqueduct built by Herod the Great. You could not, even today, you can't have a city without water. There's no natural source of water at Caesarea. So Herod the Great built an aqueduct that's 8 kilometers in length to bring water to the city from a spring at the base of Mount Carmel. And this is the remains of that aqueduct. Up on top of the aqueduct, they had found 3 ceramic pipes that were used to bring the water from the spring to the city of Caesarea. You know, used for all the things you would think about water being needed for, but also there were Jews that lived in Caesarea. They needed water for ritual washings. You had to have water. And they found these pipes up on top of here. Something else that they've also found up on top of the aqueduct is they have found engravings that identify Roman Army Unit 10 in the ruins. Now, what does that mean? Well, it is believed that Roman Army Unit 10 is the unit that destroyed Jerusalem. And it was also believed that Herod the Great, when soldiers were not actively fighting, that he used them as workers. So possibly that the same people who built the aqueduct that later, I mean, probably not the same people, but the same unit, because there's many decades between, but the same unit of the army that built this later is the one that destroyed Jerusalem. So kind of cool. But this is unbelievable to think that 2,000 years ago they could build something like this that was 8 kilometers long. Just right there on the ocean, built it all out of sandstone, and it's still there. I mean, there's huge sections of it that are still there. And got one just a picture up close just so you can see the size of this thing. I mean, it's pretty big, pretty neat. So, all right. So I'm going to cover very quickly, I'm going to cover the Jezreel Valley. And I had planned on covering Tel Megiddo. I will leave that for next time because I don't want this to just go on forever. You're like, good, we don't want it to go on forever either. The Jezreel Valley. Jezreel Valley, we'll talk about the biblical significance in just a minute, but let's kind of talk about where we're coming from. So we were just over here. On the left-hand side, it's not quite on this image, but we were just here on the coast. And the Jezreel Valley is to the interior of the country of Israel that separates the Samaritan Judean mountains from Galilee. You know, we talked about southern and northern, upper and lower Galilee and Panhandle. the Valley of Jezreel separates Galilee from the Samaritan and Judean mountains and then the coastal plain. And then through here, the kind of the south of the Valley of Jezreel, you have the Mount Carmel range, which we can talk about that in just a minute too. But notice some of the places that are on either side of Jezreel. So you've got Megiddo, which we'll talk about next time. Up at the north, you've got Mount Tabor. Down here, you've got Mount Gilboa, which is where Saul was killed, King Saul was killed. And then running right through the middle of all of that is the Valley of Jezreel. Now, most of the references to Jezreel come in the book of Judges. For those of you who were in Jeff's class that he did on Sunday mornings through Judges, that Jezreel was mentioned several times through the book of Judges. So now we're going from, you know, time of Jesus to way before, okay? So we're going back hundreds of years further. There's no ruins here. This is just talking about the geographical area known as the Valley of Jezreel. But several very significant things happen there. You read about the story of Deborah and Barak. They defeated the Canaanites in the Jezreel Valley. So Judges 4 and 5, those events that happened in those chapters took place in the Valley of Jezreel. Gideon, most of us are familiar with the story of Gideon and God having him go through the water to narrow down his army and all of that. All of that, including the battle with the Midianites, took place in the Jezreel Valley, Judges 6 and 7. And then Saul, I just mentioned that Saul died on Mount Gilboa, which is on the edge of the Jezreel Valley. But prior to that battle with the Philistines, he camped in the Jezreel Valley. Okay, so that is not in the book of Judges. That's in 1 Samuel 31. But a very important place for these significant stories in Scripture. Now, I showed this slide in last week in our kind of introductory class. Some of these slides, not all of them, but this is the Jezreel Valley from the top of Megiddo. So let me kind of reset. Megiddo is here. Mount Tabor, I'm going to show you a picture of Mount Tabor in just a minute. There's Mount Tabor. Mount Gilboa is down here. It's not on this map, but Nazareth is right about here. Okay, so all of these kind of border Megiddo, Tabor, Gilboa, and Nazareth all kind of border the Jezreel Valley. So this is taken from the top of Megiddo and looking out over the Jezreel Valley. Now this was taken in the rainy season, so it's very, very green. Next shot, similar location, taken in the dry season, a little more brown. But this is the Jezreel Valley. This is from the top of Megiddo, looking out over the Jezreel Valley to Mount Tabor. So remember our map that we were just looking at. So that's looking from Megiddo over to Mount Tabor. Okay. So back here, that's the view going across the Jezreel Valley to Mount Tabor. Now this one, we're going to go a little further to the northwest. This is still on Megiddo. That's the city of Nazareth today. Nazareth today is a modern Arab city. It's not a big archaeological site, not a big pile of ruins. It's a modern city. Very little archaeology in the city of Nazareth today. But you can see a very large city up in the mountains there of Lower Galilee. Okay, so we're looking across the Jezreel Valley to Lower Galilee. And then this not the first peak, but the second peak, that is Mount Gilboa. So now we're, again, standing on top of Megiddo, looking out over the Jezreel Valley toward Mount Gilboa. So this, again, in the valley itself, Deborah and Barak, Gideon, where Saul camped, all of that took place in this valley. And then Saul was killed on top of Gilboa, Saul and Jonathan killed in 1 Samuel 31. And then this is looking from Megiddo north. And I didn't point this out, but back to the map. There's Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel, the north, kind of northeast of Mount Carmel, is where the Jezreel Valley begins. And so this image here, this is looking kind of that northwest from Megiddo to Mount Carmel. That's Mount Carmel. So that's where 1 Kings 18, where you read about Elijah facing off with the prophets of Baal, all of that took place on Mount Carmel, which is, again, right there, looking there from Megiddo. Okay? Now, this is the other end of the valley, and all of these pictures are from the rainy season because these are all on top of Mount Tabor, and I have not been to Mount Tabor in the dry season. But all of these looking out, so this is similar, well, not similar view, but looking kind of the opposite direction toward Nazareth from Tabor. So you can see Nazareth up there in the hills looking out over the Jezreel Valley. This is, again, from Tabor looking out over, this is actually looking toward Megiddo, but it's very rainy and foggy, and so it's hard to see. But this is looking out over the Jezreel Valley toward Megiddo, so kind of looking the opposite direction of what I was just showing before. But again, real place. Now, every time I read about, you know, Deborah Barak, read about Gideon, read about Saul, I have this in my head. This is what I'm picturing, because this is where all of this happened. Okay? All right. So I'm going to say Megiddo for next time. Now I have a better sense of what I can fit in one lesson and what I can't. I was a little over-aggressive. But next time we'll talk about Megiddo. This is obviously not the kind of lesson, it's like a, you know, obey the gospel kind of lesson. I was talking at lunch today about how seeing these things for me just, you know, takes it from like two dimensions to three dimensions. And it just makes it so much more real. So much more real. Not that it wasn't real, not that any of this is required to have faith, but it makes it so much more real to be able to picture these places. When I read about, you know, Saul sailing to Tarsus, and I read about, I read about Saul camping in the Valley of Jezreel and dying on Mount Gilboa, that I can, you know, picture these things. These are real places. This is not a fairy tale. This is not a bedtime story. These are real places. These are real places. With the kids doing Bible Bowl, studying about Joshua and the places that they're coming into. You know, we're talking about Jericho and Ai, and I don't think we know where Ai was exactly, but Jericho, I've been to Jericho. So you can, you know, again, you can picture these things in the Jordan River where they crossed. You can picture these things, and it just reinforces the idea that this is not a fairy tale. This is real. And for all of us, whether we ever go to Israel or not, this has to become real to us. It has to become reality, not a fairy tale, but a reality. And when it becomes real, then we have a decision to make. What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about it? Well, God in His Scripture tells us that He sent His Son for us. And we have to make a choice of whether we're going to follow Him or not. Is it real? Are we going to follow Him? Or are we going to continue to follow ourselves? If you're here tonight and you've never made the decision to follow Jesus instead of yourself, I encourage you to think about that tonight. If there's anything else we can do for you tonight, please come while we sing our invitation song.